everyone. Candace Moore, alcoholic. Thanks for allowing me to come and hang out and participate. I used to come here a lot when you got, like, apparently many years ago, when you were at a different location altogether, but I still have some friends who are still a part of the group, and so I was asking about them tonight. People are like, why is she asking for so-and-so? None of your business. How about that? Yeah. Anyway, so you know what I mean? We're in such a crazy world right now, so if we could all just, like, do what we're supposed to do, be kind and mind our own business, I think it would be so much better. But I mean that in a loving and nurturing way. Okay. Thanks, Mark. Mark and I have been friends for a long time, and hadn't seen him for a while, and so it's great to spend some time with him before the meeting. And Aretha, I used to sponsor a long time ago. I'm probably going to talk about her a little bit. You know what I mean? And my friend Vieta. Vieta and I have been friends for forever. And so so I'm happy to be sober. You know what I mean? In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a lot of fun. And thank you, Rick. You had a lot of challenges, but you persevered. You were like, I'm going to get this story out, right? And you know, we have a lot of fun here, and that is because we honor the primary purpose. I'm here because my life is on the line. I'm a hope-to-die alcoholic. And I have a life of grace, of dignity, of respect, right? Success for me has been redefined. Success in the past was about money and who I'm with and what we can do and how it looks. And so all of that has to fall by the wayside when you realize that you're in a marathon. When I'm sprinting, sure, it's like, I just want to get here. I just want to get there. But when this becomes a way of life and we talk about success, success is trusting and being trusted. Loving and being loved, respecting and being respected. That's how I define success, and all of that equates to safety. You've given me a life that I didn't even know that I wanted because I felt unworthy. And so the thing about when you feel unworthy is you have limited vision. That's what lack of worth does. It produces a distortion, the same thing that drinking does. I loved drinking. I was having a conversation with someone I hadn't seen for a while. And, you know, my first home group was the Bellflower Big Book group for a long time. And then it was the Pacific group for a very long time. And now it's the Tuesday night, line by line, Alcoholics Anonymous Women's Big Book Workshop. And I prefer text meetings because I can't be here without it, right? When I was new, I thought that a meeting of AA was the program. I'm like, well, I'm going to meetings. I'm doing a program. No, you're going to meetings so that you can hear us share our interpretation of the program. The program is in the book, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful that I have had sponsors that have taken me through the book, that have had time and experience with the text. Here's what's heartbreaking. We're losing a lot of people. Why are we losing a lot of people in a program that is divinely ordained, that is perfectly executed in terms of the layout? And that is because so many environments, it's AB, not AA, right? My Tuesday night Zoom meeting, a lot of people, their cameras are off. And so you hope that their cameras are off because of, I don't know what reason your camera would be off, but because something important has made them turn their, but oftentimes, right, it's because they're doing other stuff. And AA is in the backdrop, right? Like I'm cooking and I'm listening to an AA meeting, or I'm shopping and I'm listening to an AA. I can't approach Alcoholics Anonymous like that. So whether I'm in person or virtual, I have to sit up. When I got here, I stood for nothing. I knew how to lay down, but I stood for nothing. So these steps have stood me up. Do you understand what I'm talking about? They have squared my shoulders and lifted my chin. I want to talk about Aretha for a second. So I sponsored Aretha, and Aretha had some challenges staying here continuously. And she still had them long after that. But Aretha and I were really close, and I knew her son and her mom. And I remember talking to her mom because her mother was exhausted. And Aretha needed to be able to have some place for a couple of weeks. And I just remember, you know, her coming in and surrendering, and it wasn't easy, and she would, like, just stay and stay. And then she got into a relationship, and she tried to hide it from me, And all her sisters were like, did she tell you? Did she tell you? And I said, you don't need to tell me. If there's something for her to tell me, she'll tell me. Right. And so the relationship wasn't healthy. And we talked about it. And I'm sharing this, you know, because Aretha's now sober 7 years. And so it's OK. But it was painful. And I want to talk about it because the relationship did not support the life she was building. And at some point, she chose that relationship and chose to leave my sponsorship. And that the relationship isn't why she got drunk again, but she got drunk again. And I remember I was talking to her mom, and she said, did Aretha call you? I said, no. And she said, she's not okay. But Aretha would call me like every 3 or 4 months, whether she was drunk or sober, she would call me to say hi. And so every time I see her, if I'm going to be in this area, I call her because she's sober and she's active in alcoholics. You know what I mean? And so it takes what it takes. I just think of the women that I may not sponsor now, but I've had this rich tapestry of sponsorship experiences that we come into Alcoholics Anonymous not knowing what this is about. And you say to me that I got to get a sponsor. I'm a grown woman. I have to get a what? To do what? And here's the thing. Wait, so let me pause there. So I get sober, right? My sobriety date, August 16th, 1995. It's the only date I've ever had, right? And so for the last 29 years, I've had to remain willing to surrender behaviors and beliefs that would prevent me from staying here continuously, which is a big word. The only thing I've ever done continuously, consistently, outside of being sober is being on the planet. Everything else has been spotty and sketchy, right? And so I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm 28 years old, but I looked at 28, the age I am now, which is 58. So I am 58 now, and I looked 58 then. Alcoholics Anonymous, this program, this process is transformative, and it is the fountain of youth, I'm going to tell you. And so I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're telling me I need to get a sponsor. I don't even know what we're doing here. I don't even know what this is about. I don't know that I'm going to stay. You know what I mean? I'm a little tired. I need a nap for sure, right? What about sponsor? And so you're like, listen, someone to take you to another woman. You want another woman? You know what I mean? So I have all those issues going on. I don't trust women. No, it's not that I don't trust you. I don't trust me. I have betrayed myself time and time again. I have said, I'm not doing this. I don't like this. I don't want this. And I couldn't stop. And so the difference between talking to a woman and talking to a man, and no offense with the men, but you're pretty easily manipulated. You know what I mean? I'll tell you. I'll give you an example. And again, I mean this in a loving, nurturing way. And so so when I got sober, I was living in a car. That's where, you know, me and the bottle, right? And it just depended. Cisco if I didn't have money, Stoli's if I did, and Cisco if I did, because I like Cisco. Yeah. And so Barry Cisco. Peach was like, ugh. And so I remember I was homeless, and then I found this car, and I was like, yay. It was like how Bill described it in his story, an oasis. You know what I mean? And in this dreary desert of futility, right? And so it was a car in a vacant lot, and at that time, in my sobriety, my life had deteriorated. Interesting, when I talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, I talk about growth, I talk about expansion, but when I talk about drinking, my life had been reduced to, you know what I mean, had deteriorated. I had come to this and that type of thing, but yet I want to stay in there. And so I was walking around, I see this car, and I get excited, and I cased it for a couple of days, and no one was there, so I was like, well, I'm moving in. And then, this guy shows up like a day later. Guy shows up and he's like, this is my car. And I'm like, okay, wait, is it your car or did you move in here first? You know what I mean? Because I respect squatters' rights. I just need to know what we're doing. So he said he had moved in the car first. Okay, well, I'm not moving. So we can be roommates. Now, here's the thing. Now I'm going somewhere with it. Here's the thing. I wanted the back seat because the front seat has a steering wheel. So that's like taking up my living room. You know what I mean? So I want the backseat because it's just like spacious. You know what I mean? It's like a condo. And so I know because he's a guy and I know that they need to be right. Again, I mean this in a loving, nurturing way. I say to him, well, I want the backseat. He's like, no, I want the backseat. I was here first. And I'm like, no, I want. He goes, no, you, no, no. I go, I want the front seat. He goes, no, you can't have the front seat. I was here first. You take the back. I'm like, no, I don't want the back. You take the back. I'm going to take the front. He goes, no, if you're going to stay in this car, you're going to stay in the back seat. I'm like, okay, I'll stay in the back. You know what I mean? I'll stay in the back seat. Jesus. Oh, it's like taking candy from a baby. Anyway, so you talk to another woman, we understand what it means to be a woman, the changes of being a woman, right? And the beliefs that go with who we are, our worth, how we show up. So, of course, I come in and you tell me that another woman should be my sponsor. And I'm like, absolutely not. And then I also think because I look like this doesn't mean I'm not brilliant. So how did you look? Oh, sure, I'll tell you. Okay. So when I got sober, I was bald-headed. Now, my hair was pretty long for the majority of my sobriety, but I'm now in the menopause phase of my development. And so my body can go to 125 degrees in like 2 seconds. You know what I mean? So I keep my hair short, cute but short. And so when I get sober, I'm bald-headed, not like some cute cut from a high-end salon. It's a la Candace, right? And so what happened is I was drinking, minding my own business, you know what I mean? And there were some things going on in my hair. They were moving around. There's a lot of movement. I don't like that when I'm trying to just get my drunk on. And so I was in this space. Who knows where I was, because I was a transient, you know what I mean? And so wherever I was, there were all these people there. And so this girl, I tell her that there's something in my hair. She's alarmed and moves back. And she's like, how do you know? I said, while we were talking, they ran from this side to that side. So she gets serious, right? She leans in. I know it's going to be good. When they lean in, it's about to go down, right? And so she tells me, in her drunken infinite wisdom, she says, you know, rubbing alcohol will sterilize anything. So obviously, I mean, my bestie just gave me this information, so I'm going to take it. And before I took the action, I didn't even know that I was practicing the traditions, tradition two. We had a group conscience, right? We totally had a group conscience. We sat down and I said, look, I know you're up there. You know what I mean? You can stay, but I'm going to sterilize you. And so I remember pouring rubbing alcohol all over my hair, and I remember it working. So before you judge me, it was totally working. It was like a meditation of sorts. It was like a renewal of spirit. And after a while, because they calmed down, but then after a while they got used to it. You know how we are, we get used to stuff, we're like, eh. So I realized they were getting aggressive, so I had to get aggressive. And I took a pair of scissors, cut off all my hair, but new friends, half measures avail us nothing, so I took a shaver, yes I did, and I shaved it to the scalp to be thorough, and then I would wear t-shirts on my head as if they were fashionable turbans, making my own statement, and a fancy day at that time in my life was when the t-shirt would have like a hint of color, like a swirl of color. I thought I was doing something, you know what I mean? Rocking it. And so I get sober and I'm 96 pounds. It was not on trend, right? And so 96 pounds because I had a diet of air, basically, right? So I would drink and enhance my drinking with a few things that kept me up for 8-9 days at a time. And then the last, just the finishing touch is I was missing my front tooth. I don't know. I shared a little something and it wasn't supported. That's what happened. And so, and I never stopped talking because I never stopped talking. So I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I think because I look like this, you're telling me that someone needs to be appointed to run my life. That's not what a sponsor is. A sponsor is a member who has gone through this process, who will, for fun and for free, that is so huge, for fun and for free, take me through this book that can save my life. I don't even understand when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm asking AA to save my life. I don't understand that is a big ask. I don't understand because I feel so insignificant. I am so broken. I feel so small that I don't think that my life is even a big deal. And so I'm so grateful that this is not about how I feel. This is about what I do. I don't have to feel like anything ever. If I'm willing to train my feet, my friend Larry T says, train your feet. I had to learn how to train my feet and shut my mouth. So when I take the actions, then my feelings change. I didn't know that. I come from a world where it's my emotions that lead my life. And you know, I mean, I'm coming from sick, twisted emotions because I live in the distorted world of alcoholism. I was raised by my grandmother, and she loved me. She loved me. She was everything to me. She was my breath. That's how much I loved her. And at night, I slept next to her because I was terrified of the dark, and I would watch her as she slept. And I started to pace my breathing to match her breathing, because if she died, I wanted to die with her. Her inhale to my inhale, her exhale to my exhale, every night until I fell asleep. Have you ever loved someone like that? That deeply? There's also something about my grandmother. She parented in a way that was a little suspect, right? And so I look back, and she would say things like, if you're going to lay down, get paid for it. I was 8. You know what I mean? Like, it's highly inappropriate. And but because I'm 8, I don't know that there's something horribly wrong with what she's saying. And so it's inventory that reveals to me, it's an inventory that I start to understand and identify. When you say I love you, I no longer question anything else. That's dangerous. Then you have my mom. So my mother gives birth to me at 17, so she's 16 when she's pregnant. My mother is extremely violent. Whatever you can think, she's horrifically violent. My mother has really big boobs. I'm going somewhere with that. I'm not just giving you her measurements. And I'm not pointing out the contrast that I'm petite, because I know that. Thank you. But I may be petite, but they're perky. You know what I mean? Anyway, so I'm not even going to tell you when I wanted to be a stripper and survive. I'm going to just leave that alone. So time does not permit. But my mom used to pack her pistol, her gun, in her bosom. Right? But big boob women do that. They like, it's just like a whole treasure trove of like stuff, you know? And so my mother would get pissed. Actually, my mom was always pissed. That was her default. She'd get pissed off. You say something, whatever, high, didn't matter. And so she only had 3 ways of resolving a conflict. The gun was always going to be a part of it. She's either going to shoot at you, or hit you with the butt of the gun. Okay? And so growing up, unconsciously, what I'm learning is from my grandmother, I always need to look good and have someone else pick up my tab, period. And from my mom, I learned that if you want to be respected, you have to demand it, you have to be loud. You know what I mean? And so I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and you teach me that respect can never be demanded. It can only be inspired. I had to unlearn so much here. So much here. I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time I started drinking, it wasn't I want to drink and hit a bottom and come into AA. I mean, like, who plans that? There's a lot of alcoholism in my family. It's not why I'm an alcoholic. It's not through osmosis. It's none of that. I'm bodily and mentally different. Period. That's it. Right? So I can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Ever. Period. That's it. And so the question, when we look at step one in the big book, right, the last chapter of step one is in more about alcoholism. And it says, right, most of us have been unwilling to admit what? That the relationship is over. I have been unwilling to admit it's not working. I'm going to try this. I'm going to go over here. I'm going to pirouette. I'm going to kick my head up. I'm going to kick my head back. But I'm not ready to let this relationship go. I'll give you an example. So and this is to our friends who have struggled, because I understand that that's got to be painful. I've had many relapses, just never in terms of my physical sobriety. I don't take anything that affects me from my neck up at any time ever in 29 plus years. But I have had many relapses in terms of behaviors, because before the physical drink, there is the sober behavior that starts to mirror as if I were drunk. And I've had relapses into behaviors I said I wasn't going to participate in anymore, right? And after almost going out at 9 years sober, I knocked that off, you know what I mean? And I've hit many bottoms here. And so the difference between, you know, someone, those of us who have come and just stayed, and those who have had to have many experiences, is I think our friends who have come many times are looking for the third door. There is no third door. That's the whole deal. It's like, okay, it's you know, I can accept this program, the spiritual kit of tools, or I can go on to the bitter end, blotting out the intolerable consciousness of my existence, which is harsh. You know what I mean? And so I'm like, I don't like any of those. What's door 3? there you're like, there is no door through. So I liken it to this. I'm in a relationship with alcohol. It's new. You know what I mean? I know where we're going. You know, I heard some good things about alcohol. It's kind of cute. Okay. Right. So I'm minding my own business. I'm in the store. I run into my ex, alcohol. Uh-oh. I run into alcohol. Alcohol's looking good. Sexy. You know what I mean? Swag. Right. And, but I am tired of the spiritual black eyes. You know what I mean? I'm tired of the loss of dignity that I experienced when I was with alcohol. So now I'm with AA, my new partner. And so alcohol's like, hey, how you doing? Right? I got butterflies. Ooh. I'm like, no, I'm good. You know, whatever. I'm good. Yeah. And so alcohol's like, it's good to see you. I'm like, yeah, you too. You know, whatever. Okay. Well, I had to go. Right? So I don't even get my groceries because I'm all like discombobulated. So I run out and I call my friend. Guess who I just ran into? Who? Alcohol. No. I know you're not going back. I know. No, I'm not going back. No, I'm with AA. No, I said I'm with AA. Mm-mm. Right? So here's the question. Am I with AA or am I just, or is AA an in the meantime relationship? Because the way I used to live, I was a cheater for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's how I was raised. I was raised that if you're only dating one person, you are a mark. I need to have the person that I'm dating. I need to have the other people that tell me how amazing I am when that person I'm dating is tripping, right? And so I don't understand that this is based in dishonesty, that this is based in scarcity, that this is based in low self-worth. I don't know because I'm in an environment where everyone speaks the same language. So when I run into my ex alcohol, I say, it's okay, I don't want to go back, but here's what happens. I start replaying the times when it was good. I start replaying the times when I was drunk over here and we were in this mansion and we were, you know what I mean? Not when it was over and I felt lost and I felt ashamed and I felt dirty. I don't want to think about that. Those strange mental blank spots. And so my friends say, block them. You know, when you have an ex, they're like, block them. And I'm like, no, I don't need to block them, you know, because I'm in AA. I don't have to block anybody because I'm not done. Why would I block you when I'm hoping you'll call? And of course, you get the text, alcohol, hey. But I'm not going to respond. But then I'm like, yeah, you know, hey, right? There it is. You want to have coffee? No, you know, I mean, we could, you know, okay, whatever, right? And so there we go, one more time. So have I surrendered? Most of us have been unwilling to admit that it's over. In step one, it says under the lash of alcohol. Under the lash means I'm getting my butt kicked. Under the lash of alcoholism, I'm driven. I'm not even driving. I'm not even calling the shots. And it says, I stand ready to lift the merciless obsession. I'm in love with something that shows me no mercy, no consideration. How is it I could possibly want to go back? And that's the insidious nature of what I suffer from. So when I started drinking, I'm in junior high. I just want to have a good time. And I don't know, I think I was like 12 or 13. I don't know when my first drink was. I know when my last one was, though. And so I start drinking. I didn't know that I was in pain until I started drinking, and it took it away. I had no idea that I was hurting until I began drinking, and it took it away. And I didn't have the emotional language to identify this is what it is, but I know that something was different, and whatever it was, I'm going to do it for the rest of my life. By 14, I'm in and out of foster homes. 15, I'm on the streets of Hollywood as a runaway. And when you are a child and you are unprotected, things happen and those things happened. Right? But those things had already happened when I was little, non-consensual experiences. All of these things are shaping me. So I'm now drinking. I'm on the streets, and so I live in constant terror, and so I do work outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is why I'm back in school full time. But, you know, I use language that references emotional dyslexia. That's when I call pain love, right? And I call terror normal. Because I'm raised in an environment, my mom was always, you know, my dad was a pimp. Where am I, Lancaster? Manager. My dad was a manager. And and so I'm raised with a certain mindset, and then you have my grandmother, who's my safe space, but my grandmother is orchestrating some things that in hindsight are damaging me. So I've lived in a certain environment for a long time, and what that means is, it's why we say don't date new people. New people, a new person is not someone in their first year. A new person is someone who's never gone through all 12 steps. There are people who have been in here for 6, 7, 8, 9 years who have never taken all 12 steps. They are as new as someone who just come in. The only thing that's different and more dangerous is because they start knowing the language, but there's been no psychic change. I can't have a psychic change if I'm not doing an inventory of searching and fearless, looking at my resentments, my fears, and my sex conduct. If I'm not in touch with how these defects of character that stem from a lack of faith cause me to overcompensate. Right? So when we talk about defects, if you say, oh, when I'm angry, oh, you must not be working a program, well, that's senseless. That does not mean, that's not a defect. If I hit you, that's a defect, right? So it says a natural instinct that far exceeds its intended purpose. If I'm attracted to you, that's not a defect. If you're with someone and I go after you anyway, that's a defect. And that what that demonstrates and what and that's revealed in my inventory is a lack of faith. I don't feel that I will be loved, that I'll be taken care of, so I simply take that. I'll take that, thank you. So I'm doing all of this stuff, and what ends up happening is my godmother, super successful, a graduate from one of the top universities in the country. She was a former journalist for the publication I worked for a number of years, and she had left and started her company, had her home, amazing space built from the ground up, right? She was an upwardly mobile black person, and she brought a child into her life that was coming from active alcoholism and extreme trauma. So her intention was good, but her skill set to deal with a child like me, she didn't have it. So she brings me into her life, and she wants to give me a good life, and I'm out of the latest foster home because I would like run away and then I'd go back to another one and all this stuff was going on. And in the interim, I would go down to hang out with my cousin who's also super successful and worked for CBS for a number of years. She's got Emmys, all kinds of stuff. So I've always navigated both worlds. I always say I am fluent. I am bilingual. I am fluent in hood and corporate, right? Just depends on what you need from me at that moment. And so So I'm living with my godmother, and she had purchased this Mercedes. She had her car for about 6 months at that point, and she was leaving to attend the Black Caucus Conference in Washington. And she mentioned, she's going to be away for a week, and she mentioned something. I don't know, it's so foggy. What was it? Something like, don't touch my car. I don't know. I can't really be sure. Because here's the thing. When you say something and it opposes anything I want to do, I have difficulty summoning it. Also, I operate from more of a sliding scale type of space. You know what I mean? So when you say something, I feel like I have wiggle room. Yeah. When I say something, however, it is law. Get clear. Yeah. So yeah, she may have uttered something about the car, but why would you not want me to take your car when I'm going to this club called the Whiskey later on that night? I mean, how am I going to get there? The bus. You know what I mean? So that whole day is spent with me and self. And I think I'm maybe 16. I'm 15 or 16. I don't know, because I'm always drunk and always loaded. So I don't know. And I'm always moving places. So I call my friend and my best friend. I tell her we're taking the car. She's like, oh, we're taking the car. Absolutely. And so before nightfall, I have to like, I don't want to just drive up like I don't know how to drive. I don't, but I'm going to just like, I'm going to take it out for a spin. I'm going to get like the feel of it. And as I'm driving the car consumed with self, how self is going to be featured, how self would be presented, you know what I mean? I run into someone else's car. Whoops. So I stood at the turning point, right? And I remember when I hit this guy's car, it was pretty bad. It's pretty bad. But you know what disturbed me? His attitude. He was so negative. He was so negative. Oh my God. I mean, I like to be in a certain, I like life to be fluid. You know what I mean? I want to be in the right space. I needed to realign my chakras after talking to this guy. And he wanted something in the way of paperwork. I don't, again, not my car, don't have paperwork, and don't like his attitude. How about that? And so I leave. There's nothing I can do here. You're accusatory in your language, okay? Super negative. And, you know, people are looking at me in a way that's unfavorable, and I don't like that. so my image is being impacted. Yeah, I gotta go. So his car is over. Forget about it. Her car, like the whole front end was like a grin. So I drive it back to her driveway, put the keys back in the candy dish, and tell my friend we're going to take a cab. The show must go on. Yeah, I made a commitment, and you know how we are. And so as I'm going through this process, I know when she returned, she's not going to be okay with the car. And she was peeved when she came back, had seen this movie, Tough Love. I've never seen this movie. I don't want to see this movie. But she was inspired and wanted me to do a couple of things that sounded like a thousand things. Because when you're in self, right, you know, one is too many and a thousand is like, forget about it. So she wanted me to volunteer my time and give of myself to a charitable organization. Now, these are the things I do now on a regular basis. They are the things I look forward to. They are the things that literally fill my heart. But at the time of living in self, it was absolutely unspeakable. And how dare she ask me to do anything like that, right? And I remember how angry she was, but it was hurt. The three words people like us hear all the time are, I trusted you. In More About Alcoholism, it says people like us are too heartbreaking. We have the gift of gab, so we sell you a bill of goods we can't make do on. You invite us into your life, and by the time we leave, you are forever changed, and not in a good way. It says if I would have been able to avoid taking you, I would have. She tried to give me a good life. She did not understand all the stuff that I was. She didn't understand why I'm drinking at 15. So a lot of times my thank you looks like that. It is in Alcoholics Anonymous that I have learned thank you is a verb. Gratitude is an action. You know, at first I felt guilty, but when I feel guilty and I don't have any tools to process, then I get pissed off. So now I'm like, you have insurance. Why are you coming down on me? Now I'm the victim, right? I tell you something. I always say when I'm sponsoring, I speak a lot of languages, but victimese is not one of them. So we are going to be standing in full accountability here. And at the time, I don't have a column four in my life. I live in columns 1 and 2, who you are and what you did to piss me off. And so that meant I'm not done. I have to keep on living like I'm living. And so I can tell I'm old because I say things that they used to say when I was growing up. You're living from pillar to post. I was living here. I was living there. And I end up, I was working at this high-end store in Beverly Hills. I met a few people and they were always giving me opportunities because I'm like enchanting. You know what I mean? And drunk and enchanting. And so this person gave me an opportunity to work for a record label. And so I didn't know that she worked for the record label. And she was she wasn't one of my best clients. There were people who spent more, but she was consistent. And so anyway, she was young, I was young, and I just thought we were cool. And she's like, you should work for record label. I was like, yeah, I should. You know what I mean? I always had a lot of sass, but not a lot of self-esteem. I didn't know that they were different, huh? So I start interviewing for this position as a receptionist. But a means to an end. I mean, yes, it's receptionist, but I know they actually mean CEO. Right, thank you, yes. And so at first, I can't even show up to the interview because I'm so nervous, so I have to take a drink and do a little something just to get me okay, but then I've overshot the mark, so I have to reschedule it. I did that 3 times. And finally, when I called, the person who was there said, the president's leaving the country for a few weeks, you have to come now. And I said, well, I'm going to be late. And she said, okay, I went not to get the job. I didn't want my friend to be upset when I saw her. Because there's no way I can cancel 3 times, come in 2 hours late for an interview and think I'm going to get the job. I didn't understand that in that industry, if someone knows you and likes you, unless you're a complete idiot, you're going to get the job. So I'm talking to the president and I look splendid. You know what I mean? Like work. And I'm loaded, so I'm really cool, right? Because I know I'm not getting it. I'm just here to chat. And so he hired me. And so so I start getting promoted. So I always try to explain the environment. It was a very different world. There was no social media. You couldn't get a lot of followers and live in the world that I live. It was super exclusive. And I needed it because I felt very common. So if you encountered me, I was very arrogant because I had nothing but secrets driving me. I'm articulate, I present well, I dress well, I blend well, but I am like driven by shame. I am terrified that you're going to find out my mother is an abusive parent who lived in South Central, and you're going to tell me you're not one of us, you don't belong here, leave. That was always driving me. I lived in self-esteem by association, who I knew, who I dated, where I lived, the title I held, especially when I started, when I got promoted to promotions. I'm promoting artists that fill stadiums. And all my friends had to be in the industry because we spoke a different language. You know what I mean? Like, I was that girl, super obnoxious. It wasn't until I came into AA that you said there's no such thing as self-esteem by association. There are only esteemable actions. The more I got promoted, the more I got loaded, I found out that my grandmother had died. And when I learned that she died, she had already been buried. Because that's how I live. I live in illusions, delusions, and facades. I don't want to go back to where I came from. I don't want to look at any of that. I lie about where I came from. I used to, those of you who are older will remember Donna Summer. Well, Donna Summer has beautiful lips, and so do I. And I would say, that's my mother. I'm her love child. She doesn't talk about it. You know what I mean? It's just always wanting to be someone else. And I'm so grateful I don't have to. That's bondage. Anytime my self-esteem and my peace is contingent on anything external, I am living in bondage. Bondage creates desperation, and desperation creates dishonesty. Because now I'll do anything. I'll contort myself. I'll compromise myself to keep whatever I think makes me okay. When we talk about obsession, obsession is not love. Obsession is about power. When I get this, I'll become that. Obsession lives in, I will be restored to something in some way. So I find out my grandmother is gone, and I don't know what to do, and I have to leave. The voices in my head are telling me I got to go, that I got to get real, but I just know how to get drunk. And so I walk in and I resign from the only life I'd ever dreamt of as a child. It was a dream come true, and it all just seemed like it just happened. But you look and you know it's the loving hand of God. I didn't have any degrees. There are people who were far more whatever. And here I am in this world, and now I'm walking away from it because I can't even show up for it anymore. I'm so drunk, I'm so loaded that the world that I desire, I feel like I can't fit in. I can't make it. And so I leave, I run out of my money, and then heartbreakingly, I run out of your money, you know what I mean? And so I had to make a decision, and that decision was to step out there and market myself in exchange for a drink. I refer to that as the public relations phase of my development, and you know, they wanted what I had, they were going to go to any length to get it, and as I'm out there, I don't take care of myself. And I remember I started in high-end areas because my dad was a manager. I would not work for one of the escort services because I don't like anyone giving me money. If I'm doing the work, I give myself money. How about that? And so I'm on the streets and, you know, it was, I mean, there are people who had a horrible time out there. I didn't. I had a great time until I didn't. And when it was awful, it was living in hell. And I don't take care of myself, and I got pregnant, and I don't want to do anything to jeopardize the life of an unborn child. I'm not that woman until I am. And I'll never do this again until I do it again. And when I found out I was pregnant, I immediately said, I can't have this baby. It doesn't mean that I believe in termination. Whether I do or not does not belong in a conversation in an AA meeting. When I was little, there were men who came in the house and they were fond of me in a way that was sick. I couldn't guarantee that a child would be safe with me, and I didn't want to risk it. So it wasn't, I'm not going to drink, because that wasn't an option. It said, I can't have this baby. And when I make that decision, I find via every news station, radio station, TV station, that a member of my family had tortured, raped, dismembered my 8-year-old little girl cousin and buried her in cement in a trash can. And that person is my mom. And she had also killed and dismembered my 2-year-old cousin. And so when all of this is going on, it's on the news, I'm on the streets, there's a baby in my belly, and I can't stop drinking. And so by the time I went through the pregnancy and And I don't know how long I was pregnant because I never went to the doctors. I just know that my belly kept getting bigger and I knew it was a baby. And so when I went into labor and I was taken to the hospital, I was terrified. I had been up for 3 days straight getting loaded. And I started praying and crying, please let my baby be okay. When I gave birth to my daughter, she was beautiful and I felt ugly. She was precious and I felt broken. And I looked at her and I just wanted peace. And I named her Serenity. That's all I wanted was peace. I didn't understand that the way I'd lived and my inability to live differently would prevent me from ever having any peace. I held my daughter and I cried and they told me that, because she was shaking and I asked why and they said she's detoxing. So that type of shame, I have to do more than come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about how many commitments I have and how I can dress well. I have to be able to do the work. I have to have a sponsor that can take me in through the trenches because I can't heal it from here. I got to heal it in here. I got to go in it to heal it. I left that hospital. My daughter was 3 days old. She did not come home with me. And it wasn't until I was 6 or 7 years sober that I looked back and remembered no one even asked me what happened to your baby. They saw that I was pregnant. I came home without a baby, but because women like me don't come home with their kids. And so when I finally got sober and tried to find her, she had been adopted. And I cried all day, but what I didn't do was leave. You told me get sober to get sober. Don't get sober to get something back. I celebrated my daughter every year for years by gifting other mothers and daughters. You taught me how to do that because you taught me how to be a service. And so in prayer, Spirit said, gift another mother and daughter. Everything I wanted to do with my daughter, I did for someone else. I just hoped that one day she would find me and not be embarrassed. She found me in 2020. She found me right before COVID. Her name is still Serenity. She's a mom. I'm a grandmother. Overnight. Glamma. Yeah. And so... And so that has been a journey in itself. I will share this with you. My daughter, I met her mom, the only mother she's known. I gifted her mother a God box. I thanked her for keeping my daughter safe. My daughter's never been beaten. She's never been violated. That wouldn't have been the story if she was with me. She found me at 24. I was about to turn 25. She was 25, about to turn 26. What if I had left when she didn't come back when I got sober? And so I started my company 6 years ago, and I was in corporate for a long time, and I do trauma work. And so in school to get all the degrees to make sure that what I do is recognized, and I published a calendar that's in honor of my daughter. That's how it started. She called me one day shortly after she had come back into my life and said, she knows everything. She knows that her grandfather was a retired manager, her grandmother was in prison for murdering kids, but because of who you created me to be, she thought I should do a motivational calendar. Is that crazy? And I used to live at MacArthur Park Estates, you know what I mean? And so, and I said, you know, thank you, but I'm never going to do it. Spirit told me to do it. And I remember publishing it, and people from all over the world, because I've spoken all over the world, started calling me, saying, how can I order the calendar? Can I get the calendar? Can I get the calendar? The calendar now just represents perseverance. Thank you. The calendar represents perseverance. I named it after my daughter for the first few years, and now it's just a More Grace meditation calendar. I share that because you took me from living in alleys, from living without dignity, and you have restored me through this process, our steps and our traditions. And I went from someone holding their head down, lying about where I came from, to building a business on it. Really? You know what I mean? And so I'm now someone who does motivational calendars. That's crazy. That's nuts. So I wish this for you. I wish for you the freedom that comes with doing what we do here. If you want what we have, I highly suggest that you do what we do. Thanks for letting me share.